This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Millions of dollars for relief are flowing into the Indian Ocean region. Billions more are pledged to help reconstruct the communities affected by the tsunami. But what if a small fraction of that money had been spent on prevention before the earthquake and tsunami? Joining us now by phone from an airport in Nairobi, Kenya, is Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. Welcome, and thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us.
It's a pleasure. I'm glad we could do it.
Earthquakes hit Japan and California, yet we don't see nearly the same loss of life, the same level of devastation as we do in Turkey or Iran or China. Is disaster prevention exclusive to rich countries?
Well, it's both a matter of early warning and disaster prevention, and the fact that when disasters hit, it's the poor who lose their lives in orders of magnitude more than wealthier people. The poor live in vulnerable areas, vulnerable structures, don't have medical help, don't have the communications, the transport, the logistics. The disasters always hit the poor so much harder than they do better off people.
And there seems to be a natural human reaction after a disaster to rush in and help. But prevention, wouldn't prevention pay for itself?
Well, it's amazing. We give emergency food aid by the billions of dollars and then dribble out 1/100th of that or 1/1000th of that in helping farmers to grow enough food. We ignore the early warning signs and then billions of dollars. But even more than that, even aside from the risks of disaster, there are ongoing disasters right now, such as the silent tsunami of malaria in Africa, where I am, where you could save millions of children this year at a fraction of the cost that we're going to spend in Asia. That is, every month more children are dying of malaria than died in the whole Asian tsunami, and yet we haven't been able to focus the world on this silent tsunami that's underway on the African continent.
Why is it that we cannot seem to muster the political will to act before there is the famine, the flood, the tsunami?
I think we don't have our eyes open, and unfortunately the U.S. government is simply not attentive to the realities out there right now. We're so consumed crisis to crisis, we've downscaled our understanding of the challenges of poor people in the world. That's not a significant place to make our investments. And the result is that we end up responsibly, generously providing billions of dollars relief to famines, to earthquakes, to tsunamis, but we miss the real benefits of saving the lives beforehand. If we were paying attention, if our government was better organized, we'd be much more responsive to the needs of the poor and their vulnerabilities and preventing these disasters, or at least reducing the vulnerability to them, I should say, well beforehand.
You point out to the U.S. government, but it's clearly not just Washington that has this problem of perspective.
Well, it's true, but the United States, given our reach, our technological capacity, our great wealth, the importance of the world for our own security, we really should be doing much better. I'm so impressed with the U.K. government, for example, that upgraded its development agency into a cabinet-level ministry, Department for International Development. Now they're ahead of the curve. They're watching. They're not just waiting for disasters. They're taking proactive steps in Africa and other parts of the world to head off disasters before they occur. We could do the same thing if we elevated our intensity of effort with respect to the poor in the world. The United States right now is flying blind, actually, but we could be doing much, much better if we want to.
You mentioned malaria. If there was one thing that, would it be a structural change in the way government approaches these situations, or one problem that you would attack if you had your choice?
Well, you take malaria. Up to 3 million children will die of malaria this year. So we're talking about 200,000 deaths per month, approximately. And something as simple as bed nets to keep the mosquitoes away, plus effective medicines which are known and proven in success, could cut by 1 million or more those deaths, even 2 million or more. A and yet we're spending, by every estimate, about 1/30th of what we need to spend. It turns out if every person in the rich world would spend just $3 a year, that would be $3 billion. That would allow us to distribute the bed nets. That would allow the effective use of the medicines. That would save millions of lives, $3 for each rich person on the planet. That's the United States, Europe, Japan, and the other high-income countries. That's all it would take. And I think we can do this once the American people realize the bargains that are there to save lives and to help stabilize unstable parts of the world and thereby improve our own security.
Jeffrey Saxon, I know it's late there in Kenya. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us tonight.
Well, I really appreciate it. It's good to speak with you today. Thanks so much.
Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and he joined us by phone from the airport in Nairobi, Kenya. Today we're talking about the money. $350 million has been pledged by the U.S. government for aid in the tsunami victims thus far. Americans, private individuals, have donated a like amount. The question today is, how should that money be spent? We can't stop earthquakes, hurricanes, tsunamis. We can't forecast a lot of natural disasters. But experts say we can and should reduce their impact. In other words, they argue that as governments and NGOs plan how to spend this money, disaster prevention should be part of the reconstruction goals. Later in the program, CBS announced today that it fired four executives for their parts in the discredited 60 Minutes report on George Bush's National Guard service. But first, recovery from natural disaster. If you've been affected by earthquake or flood, was housing moved to higher ground afterwards? Building and bridges and highways made stronger and safer? And if you've donated money for the tsunami victims, how would you feel about it being spent to possibly prevent the next disaster? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Tom Brennan, who recently retired as the Asia Regional Advisor for the United Nations Bureau for Crisis Prevention and Recovery. He was also Asia's Senior Regional Advisor for the U.S. Office for Foreign Disaster Assistance for 10 years. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You've spent decades working in Asia on disasters, first in response, now in reducing the possible impact of disasters. What changed your thinking?
Being in Asia, actually. I just started off as a response person, that is, responding to disasters after the event. But the longer I spent in Asia, the more obvious it became to me that mitigation, disaster reduction, managing the risks would really pay off a lot better in the long run and cost a lot less money.
Well, help us out. I mean, when we speak of disaster reduction or prevention, what is it? How does it work?
Well, it depends really, I guess, on the kind of disaster we're talking about. But in the case of, say, earthquakes, it is better building codes, enforcement of the building codes, better search and rescue methods, improvement of health facilities, and so on. In the case of hydrometeorological disasters, floods and storms, which in fact is Asia's most common and costly disaster type, it is early warning, forecasting, and enabling farmers to adjust their planting schedule, for example, to plant earlier or later depending upon what the climate is going to bring. In the case of storms, cyclones or typhoons, it is, again, early warning, but also providing evacuation facilities. So each kind of disaster has some very obvious mitigative measures that can be taken, but they're not standalone. It's a package of things that need to be done.
Mm-hmm. Typically, how much does it cost? And I guess the comparison we're making is to disaster relief.
Oh, just a fraction of the cost. To deal with, to put in place programs that would mitigate the impact of disaster events, that is earthquakes and typhoons, floods, in all of Asia would cost perhaps $10 million a year. But it must be a program for a number of years. So it would take probably about 8 years to put in place in any particular country a solid program that would address these issues. So we're talking $80 million overall over the next, say, 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Some of this you talked about, for example, building codes and enforcement of building codes. This is better governance.
Correct. It is better governance.
And is that controllable by outside agencies providing aid?
Yes, they can provide alternative ways of doing it. Turkey, in fact, has recently adopted a creative way of enforcing building codes, recognizing that, indeed, there is a level of corruption there that makes it virtually impossible for government to adequately inspect buildings as they are being constructed. So they're contracting out to what they call design and construction supervision firms. And these are private firms that whose employees are bonded and insured. And these firms then take on the responsibility of approving each design for a building and going out and inspecting it while it's under construction to make sure it adheres to code. And then that firm itself becomes responsible for any collapse over the next 20 years.
And as we saw in earthquakes in Turkey not so long ago, actions like that taken years ago could have saved thousands of lives.
Absolutely. And cost next to nothing. It's just a creative way of approaching the problem.
Let's see if we can get a call in before the break. This is David, who's with us from Gilbert, Arizona.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Very good. Thanks. Go ahead.
I donated to the relief effort, and of course I wouldn't mind that money being spent on prevention. Actually, I'd make another donation if I knew that's where the money was being spent. And then I just wanted to bring up just one quick topic, and it's all the negative news about the Americans not giving enough. With the private sector donation, doesn't that make us the leader on the nation total now? And I'll get off the air.
Okay, thanks for the call, David. And I actually think Australia, in terms of absolute dollars, is leading the donations. But I think the complaints about the amounts made by that United Nations official who was so roundly criticized, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tom Brennan, but wasn't he talking about amounts donated annually in terms of foreign aid as opposed to disaster relief?
I think he was talking about both, although I didn't hear his comment. But what reports I heard was that, in fact, he was talking about the problem you just mentioned, aid in general, and which we rank very low, at least amongst the developed countries.
Okay, we'll be back after a break with more of your calls. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about disaster reduction and prevention. What can be done to limit the impact of future natural disasters? Our guest is Tom Brennan, the former Asia Regional Advisor for the United Nations Bureau for Crisis Prevention and Recovery. And joining us now is Peter Webster, a professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, welcome.
And, of course, you listeners are invited to join the discussion. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And, Peter Webster, you're leading a project in Bangladesh that does flood forecasting, which help farmers in particular. What do they do with this information?
Well, what we're trying to do is provide information to the farmer, and that's a long process that I'll explain in a moment, so that they can be strategic about their decisions for food security and also make tactical decisions on the shorter time scale. The problem is that floods occur at many different times of the year in Bangladesh, and sometimes they interfere with both harvesting or cropping or planting of rice. And what we hope to do is be able to tell the farmer that it might be optimal for him to be able to harvest 5 or 6 days early, even though the yield will be less, than wait for his crops to be washed away. And so we work with the agricultural extension people in Bangladesh, and they will indeed themselves work with the agricultural extension officers, and the information is passed down that way.
Mm-hmm. Does this involve sophisticated technology at all?
Yeah, it's a technology which has come from many years of science, and what we tried to do is two things. One is find a regional application for the science, and two, leave the Bangladeshis with technological means to be able to do their own forecasting. I truthfully believe that's probably the most important thing that we can do to a developing nation is provide techniques and information that they can go on and use themselves and adapt to their own particular needs.
Bangladeshis, of course, understand the urgency of this. It was not all that long ago that, what, hundreds of thousands of them died in flooding as a result of a typhoon.
Yes, that was, I think, in the late 70s, and it was a dreadful thing. But the warning systems that one can set up for hurricanes are a little different from the warning systems one sets up for floods. But at the moment, in Bangladesh, the equivalent of their NOAA, the Bangladesh Meteorological Department, doesn't have a numerical capability like we have here to be able to forecast where a hurricane will occur or where a flood will occur and what the intensity of the storm surge will be. And that's the type of training that we would like to impart to the Bangladesh. They're so darn cheap. These exist as modules that we can pass on to the Bangladeshis, and they'll be prepared to handle these problems themselves.
You say it's so darn cheap. How cheap is it?
Ah, well, in the totality of life, not much money. For about the most important thing that I can think of is that it has to be prolonged support at moderate levels. We can continue to provide and train for flood forecasting. That's giving seasonal flood forecasting or monthly or weekly flood forecasts. And that'll cost about $250,000 a year with full training for the Bangladeshis and to do some of the more complicated tasks themselves. We're talking about $500,000 a year for 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And where do you get that money from now?
Well, that's the problem. We did receive for a few years, 4 years, funds from USAID. Unfortunately, their philosophy seems to have changed from preparedness to reaction to disasters, which is, as I say, philosophically not the way I would like to see things go. So at the moment, we're sort of marching time. There is the possibility of funding from the Dutch government and also maybe CARE, but we'll have to wait and see in the next few months for that.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Bill, who joins us from San Jose, California.
I was wondering what role the media had played in warning the tsunami victims. For example, I would think that there'd be a lot of radios in those places that were hit by the waves, and if the news services had any information about the oncoming tsunami, they could have
told the people to get out of the way. The fact is, perhaps a warning system will be installed, and there will be meetings, as I understand, next week in Kobe, Japan, to discuss this sort of thing, Bill. But those systems weren't in place before the tsunami. I wonder, Peter Webster, are radios broadcasting to farmers? Are they part of your communication system?
Well, no, it's mainly handled down through government agencies. But there's a problem with a warning system for something that might occur once every 50 to 100 years versus a warning system for example, in Florida, where you have hurricanes 4 or 5 times a year. People have a memory from 1 year to another, and it's going to be hard to train really some billions of people to be aware of something that might happen in 10 years or 20 years' time. There are radios. Most villages have radios. But it's a matter of training. How do you train a local population to be aware and to know what to do? And one of the problems for example, in Bangladesh, it's a warning is one thing, and doing something about it. For example, you are going to have a storm surge or a tsunami or whatever. It's not a matter of getting in one's family car and heading inland. The road systems and the transportation systems, of course, are not what we would find in the United States. So the planning that is required for mass evacuations has to take on a completely different philosophy, so to speak, than we would have in a first world nation.
Peter Webster, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Peter Webster, professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and he joined us by phone from his office there, and we thank him for his time. And still with us is Tom Brennan. And Tom, here's an email we got from Dale Hogan in Galveston, Texas. To take a page from history, in 1900, a hurricane killed about 8,000 people on this barrier island. The people decided never to let that happen again. They razed most of the remaining buildings on the island, raised the grade by 17 feet at the shore, and built a seawall. These heroic efforts over 100 years ago have kept our island viable and beautiful. Are those kinds of prevention measures, there? You could think of a lot of places where those could be useful.
Indeed. And, well, Peter Webster brought up Bangladesh and both floods and cyclones. And in fact, Bangladesh, the big one was actually 1970,
mm-hmm.
when they lost 300,000 people. But in 1991, they had one where they lost 138,000 people dead. Since then, they have put in place a early warning system for cyclones that is very effective. And in 1999, they had a similar size. You can never compare two different disaster events are not completely comparable. But the cyclone in 1999 was of about the same magnitude as the cyclone in 1991. The tides were a bit different, and that helped them somewhat. But most importantly, they had a good warning system in place. The science is not perfect, but it's adequate enough for them to have determined that indeed a cyclone that might affect very many people is heading toward their shore. And this message gets passed down and ultimately depends upon 20,000 volunteers who go house to house on their bicycles and advise people, first, that the cyclone is coming, second, that it's going to hit them, probably, third, that it's going to arrive at a certain time and they must leave their home and go to the cyclone shelter. And they have constructed cyclone shelters all along the coast. These are high, raised on stilts, concrete stilts, large, massive structures where people will be safe from the cyclone. So in 1999, despite their having a cyclone of similar magnitude, they lost only 109 people compared to 138,000 people 9 years earlier.
Let's get another caller in. This is Kevin, joins us on the line from Boise, Idaho.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call, and I'll take the answer off the line.
Okay.
But I'm curious to know, with the talk about building codes, there seems to be, at least in my case, with local building codes where I had a problem with my house that they can't even enforce because they're so busy. How would we enforce or expect other nations, especially in Asia, to enforce their own codes, even if we had people looking at them?
Tom Brennan?
Well, indeed, as Turkey has demonstrated, there are creative ways to approach this. You can contract it out, basically, outsource it. Government is not perhaps the most effective instrument for carrying out building inspections.
Here's an email we got from Andra Crippen just on this subject in Anchorage, Alaska. As everyone is surely aware, she writes, Anchorage was hit by a very large earthquake in 1964. Large areas of the city sank and a lot of the area went into the inlet. You'd think with all the science available today that there would be prohibitions against building in the areas that already sank and in areas that are liable to sink in the next big quake, which is overdue. But there are large buildings going up and luxury homes being built on the vulnerable areas. Just goes to show you that no one is thinking ahead.
Exactly. Actually, that's a very good point because there's probably a number of reasons why we don't do better prevention. But that's, I think, number two, that there's no strong demand for it from the people who might be affected. They do want warning, but they don't want to be told whether it's in the coastal areas of Florida or the Mississippi floodplain that they can't build their homes there. Thank you very much. You know, we don't want EPA, stronger EPA regulations. At the same time, there's no political pressure on the U.S. Agency for International Development to go out there and do more to prevent disasters, whereas when a disaster occurs, there's calls from congressmen probably 20 or 30 a day saying, do more, especially if they have constituents from the country that was affected. Also, the problem of multi-year funding. Any of these activities for prevention are not simply one-off things, whereas the response, you can spend all that money, hopefully in 9 months or a year. But if you're going to put in place a program that will prevent disasters, as I said earlier, it's going to take 7 or 8 years, and typically agencies do not want to commit money for that long time because they sort of mortgage their future. And maybe ultimately it does reduce the number of disasters and the number of victims very considerably, but for the next 7 or 8 years, I have that mortgage I have to pay every year out of my budget, and maybe something else will happen, another tsunami like we had in India, the Indian Ocean,
mm-hmm.
and we won't have that money available because it's committed to this prevention program. There's also, I guess, a certain amount of bureaucratic inertia. The Asian Development Bank's Board of Governors realized that, indeed, you know, in Asia, disasters are enormous, and they take a tremendous economic toll as well as a loss of life. And so they decided that they would have policy in the bank that made sure that what they were lending for would mitigate rather than contribute to disasters. And the task force, of course, drew up the proper policy. But then as it made its way through the different offices that are charged with actually making loans to different countries, it basically eviscerated it because it required them to do more work to make sure that, for example, that if they were funding school construction in Sumatra, that that those schools are going to be built to seismically safe standards. And that would have slowed down the whole loan process. And they don't get rewarded for being slow. They get rewarded for moving that money out as fast as they possibly can.
Tom Brennan, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're most welcome.
Tom Brennan, former senior regional advisor for Asia for the U.S. Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, and he joined us from his home in Florida. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Andrew Maskry, chief of the Disaster Reduction Unit at the United Nations Development Program in Geneva. He's with us by phone from his home in France, and it's good to have you on the program.
Okay, thank you. Good evening. Well, good morning. I guess good afternoon to you guys.
Yes, thank you very much. Next week, the Japanese government hosts a long-scheduled World Conference on Disaster Reduction. Obviously, given recent events, the tsunami will be discussed. Do you think things will be different at this year's conference?
Well, I think certainly the recent tsunami and earthquake disasters will, I mean, have put a lot of highlight on the issue, and one hopes that there would now be more political commitment than if this, you know, unfortunate event hadn't happened. Having said that, I think the challenge is to make sure that the political commitment doesn't just appear for a few months while this is still fresh in everyone's mind and then rapidly evaporate again, you know, in 6 months or so time.
Do donors support disaster reduction?
Well, I think, you know, it's no secret that most of the money that's associated with the word disaster goes on relief. You know, disaster relief is sexy politically for some of the reasons that Tom Brennan just mentioned. It's quick. It's one-off. You can disburse the money. It provides plenty of exposure and opportunities for politicians. It gets, you know, stories in the news. Disaster prevention does exactly the opposite of that, in the sense that if you're successful, nothing at all happens. And nothing at all happening is not often very good for politics. Mm-hmm.
Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Blake, who's with us from the Bighorn Basin in Wyoming.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
What I'd like to say is a little bit about education right now with the money that we're putting into this. For example, back in the Kobe earthquakes, what they did after that, they sent us over there. We would take wood, shear, ply, rebar schedules, and we taught them a little bit about what we do over here in America. The same thing could be happening over there with this money, basically teaching them how to do just simple shear ply scheduling with nailing, the proper building procedures, and showing them so that as they do develop their cultures, they can apply these principles to their people and tell them what to do.
Andrew Maskry, is that one of the elements of prevention, as even as you could use reconstruction and immediate aid relief to do that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think reconstruction as I said, the disaster is a tragedy, but it's also an opportunity because once everything, in a sense, has fallen down, it gives you a unique opportunity to build it up in a better way, something which is usually almost impossible to do otherwise. And what the caller has just mentioned, I think, is actually very relevant and very important because earlier in the program you were discussing the issue of building standards and the difficulty or almost impossibility of enforcing building standards, particularly in rural areas or shanty towns and urban areas, even if those standards exist. So if we could rule that out as something which basically does not work very well, you know, the alternative we have is really massive programs of training. I mean, training local builders in simple, safe building techniques can make a difference, an enormous difference, far more difference than building standards can make. So anything which has to do, you know, with raising people's own capacity to build better, local contractors, local builders, raising that kind of awareness, giving them the tools and the techniques they need, this is all, I think, you know, certainly music to my ears.
Blake, thanks very much for the call. And Andrew Maskry, we wanted to thank you very much for your time today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Andrew Mascri is chief of the Disaster Reduction Unit at the United Nations Development Program in Geneva and joined us by phone from his home in France. When we get back from the short break, CBS fires four employees, four executives for their part in Memogate. That's the George Bush National Guard story. More on that after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.